Welcome back to a retrospective of Background Briefing's coverage of the Russia-Trump story. And let's now go to a broadcast from November the 26th, 2017. And joining us now is Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He is the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. He blogs at the Belly of the Beast and has an article with Bill Moyers at billmoyers.com, The Trump-Russia Story is Coming Together. Here's how to make sense of it. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Harper.
Well, thank you for the generous and kind words, Ian. I appreciate it. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you. And I thank you for the work you've done, because it is a tangled web. Oh, what tangled webs we weave when first we practice to deceive. And you've got over 700 entries here, a map and a timeline, which I guess, film directors and screenwriters do this when they're trying to work out a movie plot line. So you've sort of worked out this plot line.
I would add to that, so do trial lawyers. In my career, really, I've been an adjunct faculty at Northwestern for 20 years teaching trial advocacy and professional responsibility. But my breadwinning career was as a trial lawyer, where what I had to do was really master very complex cases, industries, and so forth, and try to distill them in a way that you could make sense of them, first to myself and then second to a jury, because ultimately it doesn't matter what you have in your head. If you can't convince the trier of fact that there's a narrative that makes sense, it all kind of falls apart. And you're right, we're up somewhere around 800 entries. When I started this thing, the timeline that is at billmoyers.com back in late January, we had two dozen entries, and it was really just part of my effort to say, look, readers, pay attention to what's happening, because there's a real story here involving Russia. And I just had what at that point were really, I thought, 24 highlight points that since then have now evolved into literally 800 separate entries on the timeline. I would call it a labor of love, but it's more a labor born of fear. Because it just, you become fearful for, frankly, the fate of democracy when you start to put a lot of these different, as you correctly noted in your introductory remarks, the various, what I think are strands, as they begin to coalesce and form a fairly coherent narrative. But you have to be willing to sort of sift through it all to get to that process of distillation.
Well, of course, the shoe that dropped this week is the revelation that Michael Flynn, the short-lived national security advisor, is likely cooperating with Mueller, and his lawyers are no longer talking to Trump's lawyers. That, of course, is significant. And Flynn, of course, was the first person that Trump tried to shut down the investigation of, Mike Flynn. That's what the purpose of his meeting with Comey, which Comey revealed in his testimony. And my sense is that there's a sort of personal subtext here to some extent. Who's left in this country to defend democracy, as you just pointed out? It's under threat. The Republicans are just shameless. They're absolutely despicable in their complicity and their silence, except for a couple of notable people like Bob Corker and Jeff Flake. So what's it come down to save America from Trump and his Russian cohorts?
Well, I guess, as in all things, it comes down to the people, because, and what you say is precisely correct. And the thing that has really astonished me more than anything else, I'm not astonished that Trump has continued really from the outset to do everything he could to minimize defeat, block, stop the investigation, obstruct it really in every way, in any way that he can. But I have really been surprised in a very unpleasant way at the ongoing complicity of the GOP. I guess they're just all locked into their short-term agendas, and as long as they have anyone, literally you could say anyone who can sign a pen that will authorized legislation that they pass as part of their short-term agenda, then they're willing to sacrifice democracy in the process of doing that. I've just been astonished. I think if you had told, if you'd taken a poll of Americans, and even if you'd taken a poll, I think, of American Republicans who said, and you asked them on the day after the election, what would you think and how would you respond if it turned out that the Russia investigation became sufficiently serious that within a matter of months, Trump would have fired the FBI director after trying to pressure him into shutting the investigation down? What would your response to that would have been? And I have to believe at that point, people would have said, you've got to be kidding me, he'll never do that. But we've gone through this incremental process of eroding, you know, norms that have really made us a civilized democracy for a long time. And without those norms, I think the republic is really in peril. And I'm not a person who's given to hyperbole, but you ask, you know, what saves us now? And I think in many, many ways, the fate of the country is in the hands of Robert Mueller. And I am confident that he knows that. And we'll you just have to hope that, against hope, that Trump's next move, you know, won't be to some way figure out a way to fire Mueller and shut the whole thing down, issue pardons to anybody who would otherwise be a target, and just say, there, you know, it was all fake news, it was all a hoax, told you so. But the good news, I think, is that Mueller is moving, you know, relative to historical standards, he's moving extremely quickly for a special prosecutor. You know, the Whitewater thing was around for 8 years. It took 2 years into Watergate before Richard Nixon finally resigned. And we already have with Mueller two indictments as well as a guilty plea confession that really goes in many ways to the heart of what was happening during the campaign. It certainly adds to the guilty plea confession, I think it does, and continues to reach higher ups. The Flynn thing will be an interesting thing to watch to see how that develops.
Well, what we know so far from Comey would indicate that there is some the possibility of obstruction of justice.
Yes.
But do you have to prove that what was being obstructed is a crime?
No. You can obstruct justice, as George Papadopoulos, the fellow who confessed and pled guilty, acknowledged. What he wound up pleading guilty to was lying to federal investigators. Now, the next question is, what was he lying to federal investigators about? And the answer is he was lying about the Trump campaign's connections to Russia and contacts to Russia. So, you know, the White House's initial spin on the whole Papadopoulos guilty plea agreement was, you know, he didn't get into any trouble for anything he did. He got in trouble for lying to federal investigators, and nobody should ever do that, glossing over the fact that what he lied to federal investigators about was the nature of the Trump campaign contacts to Russia. Now, the question is, what else? And there are a number of bases that you could think of that could lead to criminal wrongdoing with respect to the nature of those contacts with Russia. You could be involved, if you were involved in, for example, actively promoting and disseminating or aiding and abetting or part of a conspiracy to distribute stolen, hacked documents from the DNC. That would be a computer-related crime. You could have a situation where if you were accepting help from a foreign government in order to help win an election, you would be in violation of campaign finance laws. But you can obstruct justice by simply lying when a federal investigator, whether it's congressional or Robert Mueller as special counsel or the FBI, asks you questions and you lie to them about it. And that's sufficient to get you to obstruction of justice, wholly apart from the question of what you're lying about.
Well, there are, of course, as you point out, these moments where so much happens that would indicate a couple of key dates. Of course, the June meeting in Trump Tower being one. A month after that, the WikiLeaks data dump happens. Donald Trump, when Junior says, when he's told about what the Russians are going to provide at this meeting, if you have what you say you have in terms of dirt on Clinton, I love it. Well, a month later, the data dump happened of the DNC hack. It's hard not to suspicious.
And roughly simultaneously with the Republican, with the successful effort by the Trump campaign to weaken the Republican Party platform plank on Ukrainian sanctions over Crimea. You know, you always look for the quid pro quo in all of this, and that's where you kind of get into the strands that you alluded to, which is the follow the money trail. And you're right, there are moments, and that's sort of the value of the timeline, I think, in the timeline exercise, where you can actually look at a particular day or look at several days and say, okay, well, what was happening around this time? Because the difficulty with the way much of the information has dribbled out, and frankly, some of the way in which the media has covered it, is that they don't provide readers or listeners with anything that gives them context to the specific event that happens. If all of this stuff had dribbled out in a coherent narrative at the same time, it would be a simple story. People would look at it and they'd say, "Are you kidding me? There are all these connections with WikiLeaks. Wait, you mean when Trump said that there had been no contacts with his campaign, there actually had been 31? You mean when he said there'd been no meetings, there had actually been 19? Wait a minute. But the stuff is dribbled out in such a fashion that I think, Americans kind of become, I don't know if hardened's the right word. You just sort of become numb to it all.
Right. Well, of course, the hot date that you refer to in June, the meeting, Jared Kushner was in that meeting, but also what coincided with that date was when Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, hired Cambridge Analytica to do the digital campaign. And as we know, there was pressure put on Facebook to get rid of the human curation of their news, since 3/4 of Americans get their news from Facebook. And Zuckerberg folded and got rid of the human curation and then brought in the algorithms. And immediately Cambridge Analytica were able to game those algorithms and all the Russian fake news amplified with their bots and troll farms. And that was a big factor in the victory of Donald Trump. Also the other hot date, of course, is later, October the 12th. So walk us through that one as well. We only got a couple of minutes left here.
Sure, that's a great one. October 12th, we have these email exchanges in September and October between Don Jr. and WikiLeaks. Those surfaced just recently. And on October 12th, Roger Stone, longtime Trump confidant, is telling NBC that he has back-channel communications with WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks sends a private message to Don Jr. suggesting that Trump publicize the Clinton documents from WikiLeaks, and lo and behold, 15 minutes later, Trump obliges. And then 2 days after that, Don Jr. tweets the URL link, the very URL link that WikiLeaks had asked him to put out there. So who was it, Emma Bull, who said... Coincidence is the word we use when we can't see the levers and pulleys. That's an awful lot happening in a very short period of time on a single day that sure looks peculiar.
Well, the timeline is available where again? We've got to...
BillMoyers.com is the best place to find it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really grateful for anyone, particularly you. It's such a pleasure to come to encounter someone who's so fully up on the facts that it reassures me that there's hope for us.
Well, it's the thing that's frustrating about this story is that on the right, Republicans, the Cold Warriors, etc., and red baiters, they're all in denial about it. And then on the left, you've got people like the editors of the Nation magazine and others. Basically saying that there's no there, and where's the proof? And that's, of course, the line from RT, Russia Today. And this whole story begins with Guccifer hacking into Sid Blumenthal's email, which is a soft spot, which is how intelligence operations operate.
Yep.
They, through hacking into Sid Blumenthal, they discover Hillary's private server. And, of course, that became a massive issue in the campaign. And then RT, Russia Today, then goes publicizes the existence of Hillary's server as in the public interest, as they say. So that's how it all began. And it's it's been a tangled web ever since. So let's stay on top of it, and I'd like to be back in touch with you.
I'd be happy to talk to you anytime. Anytime I can get an ear, I'm happy to talk about this for as long as people
okay.
are willing to listen to me.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster Story. He blogs at Belly of the Beast and has an article at BillMoyers.com with Bill Moyers. The Trump-Russia story is coming together. Here's how to make sense of it. And that was from Background Briefing's November the 26th broadcast. This has been a retrospective of Background Briefing's 2017 coverage of the Trump-Russia story. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ian@backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Happy New Year, and bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.